Your sausage McMuffin with egg didn't change. Your receipt did. The sausage McMuffin with egg extra value meal includes a hash brown and a small coffee for just $5. Only at McDonald's for a limited time.
Price and participation may vary. Promotion pricing may be lower than meal pricing.
Andy and Anna here from your new favorite podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
Yes, we are two of the four hosts of the podcast that stuffs fascinating, amazing, weird, mad facts into your ears on a weekly basis. You got any good facts, Andy?
Yes, how about this one? Anteaters have evolved on 12 separate occasions.
Wow.
Mysterious. Wonderful.
The world really wants them to exist. What about this one? When Ronald Reagan left office, he left a note on the White House lawn for the squirrels, warning them to beware of George Bush's dogs.
So there you go. If you like fascinating facts and much more besides, we are No Such Thing as a Fish.
Eggpod Express with me, Chris Shaw. Eggpod Express takes a jaunty stroll through 1960s music magazines with a potpourri of delicious guests. To read along with us, the magazine's online at iamtheeggpod.com. And to support this podcast and to act as bonus content, please subscribe to patreon.com/eggpod, where you'll also find an exclusive playlist of this week's top 30 singles. In this episode, the last in the current series, I'm joined by music journalist, writer, co-host of the brilliant Word in Your Ear podcast, and the man who launched magazines such as Smash Hits, Q, Mojo, Empire, Heat, and The Word, David Pepworth. Hello.
Hello there.
I can think of no one more qualified to talk about 1960s music magazines. And we spoke before about your memories of growing up with the soundtrack of the Beatles. So, David, take us back to June 1967.
Yeah, it's June the 17th, 1967. So that's just before my 17th birthday. And so I'm in the sixth form at school. And we're looking at a copy of the New Musical Express, of course, which is what it was called in those days. It says every Friday, which kind of slightly surprised me because I always thought it came out on Thursday. It certainly did later in later years. And the question of whether you could get it on the day of sale or whether you were situated in such a place in the UK where you could actually get it a day early was an absolute major division amongst, you know, the haves and the have-nots of the pop-picking process back in those days. But anyway, it says every Friday, sixpence, 6D, it was half a shilling, you know, 2.5p, I suppose, in new money, what I still regard as new money. I don't know whether I would have bought this one. If I hadn't bought it, I would certainly have looked at it. Because, you know, those were in the days when the habit of buying a weekly music paper, and it was a paper, not a magazine, was established, you know, to the extent that I would arrive at Wakefield bus station on my way to school and would call in the tiny newsagent opposite the bus station to see if it was there. And I can well remember the gloom that would absolutely descend over your entire week on those occasions when it wasn't there.
Yes. You know,
and this would happen because distribution screw-ups or industrial disputes, which was certainly a big issue in the 1970s, not as much in the 60s. And your whole plan for the day was planned in the light of the enemy or the record mirror being there, you know, and being able to gorge yourself on its content, you know. So, and if you didn't buy one, if you bought the record mirror or the Melody Maker or Disc and Music Echo, as I think it was, yes, one of those things.
Yeah.
You know, and if you bought one and somebody else would buy another, you know, there would be a kind of swapping at lunchtime, you know, the people looking over the stuff. And of course, the other thing I remember about music papers and later in magazines with my experience at Smash Hits was that these things were largely consumed on the top deck of a bus. That's wow, what happened. You know, they were shared things, you know.
So this is on the way to school or?
Or on the way back from school. You know, if somebody had a copy of the New Musical Express or the Melody Maker or a Camaro or whatever, and they would sit on the back of the bus and, you know, get it open, and there'd be three people reading over their shoulders. That's how you did it, you know, because it was your only source of information about that kind of stuff, because this is before the newspapers. If your family got a newspaper in those days, you know, Daily Express or Daily Mail or Mirror or whatever, it wouldn't really have any pop news in it at all. And then that all happened years later when they started adopting that kind of thing. So your only way of knowing whether somebody was going on tour or whether, you know, the herd had broken up or, you know, the Mark Lehman Five had lost a member or whatever. The only way you would know is if you saw some tiny little piece, yes, in the music paper, very often weeks later, you know, these tiny fragments. So what you have to imagine to bring back the idea of what the music papers and magazines keyed into was that there was effectively an information blackout about popular music. Mm. It was though there was a war, you know, it was classified information. it wouldn't be shared with people at all. The only way you would get to know is if you read those papers and you read those tour dates and lists of releases and so forth.
And it's also things like TV appearances and radio appearances and internet.
Oh, it is, absolutely. I mean, that's what I always say about the NME, particularly in the mid-70s. The enemy was the internet. Just imagine, it was everything that is currently on the internet was in one paper that came out once a week. And it was your only way of knowing about all those things. And of course, you know, I quoted this when I wrote my 1971 book, that Jim Morrison dies in Paris in 1971. And the first anybody knows about it in the UK is there a small news item saying, just as we're going to press, we've heard a rumour that Jim Morrison has died. And then a week later, it was confirmed. So effectively, 2 weeks after the event is when anybody got to know. Because that kind of thing wouldn't have been in the Times.
Well, no.
Wouldn't have spread out into that world at all. You know, so it was... And I think I'm right in saying when Jim Morrison's office wanted to confirm that he died or not, they rang the Melody Maker.
Wow.
Because they were in California and he was in Paris, you know what I mean? And the world was just not wired up in any way, anything like the way it is now, you know. And
no.
You know, whereas nowadays, I always say this, if there's any item of news, any item of major news nowadays, the very last place you will hear it is on the front page of a newspaper or on a TV news bulletin.
Yes.
You just won't.
Yeah.
Yeah. They will confirm what has been, you know, spread about on social media or whatever. That's just, and that was unimaginable reversal of the way things used to work, you know.
That very much reminds me of, you know, Simon Galloway from Giddy Carousel of Pop.
Right, yes,
podcast. Yes. I did Smash Hits podcast. And he bought some old reel-to-reels a couple of years ago, and somebody had recorded, I'm pretty sure it was Radio Luxembourg, and it was just a continuity announcer, blah, blah, blah. And it happened to be the very tape where Brian Epstein, and it was a breaking news, and it was Alan Fluff Freeman, breaking news. And the reporter said, we've heard a report that Brian Epstein has been shot. And that was how, and then it cuts back. And now over to our next show. Hi, everybody.
Yes. What? Well, the other stuff was no doubt recorded weeks before. You know, the news would have been the only live thing.
News flash. We interrupt this program to bring you a Caroline Newsbeat news flash.
It appears that Mr. Brian Epstein, the Beatles' manager, has been found in his flat shot dead. And that is the end of the Radio Caroline News. The next news tomorrow morning at 6 a.m.
So talking of that, was radio a big part of your childhood as well?
Well, this is also, if I'm recalling correctly, this is just before the launch of Radio 1. So Radio 1 was late summer 1967, if I recall correctly,
yes.
With, you know, Flowers in the Rain, the Move being the first record played. And I've droned on about this endlessly, and I will continue to drone.
Drone away.
You know, is there were very few records played on the radio in those days. They had needle time agreements with the musicians union and the record companies that they would only play. I think they played 40 hours in a week or something like that. It was, you know, spread out over a week. It was not a lot of records. And so the majority of BBC music radio output, and this applies whether it was the light program or whether it was Radio 1, most of it was kind of, it was easy listening, kind of the Northern Dance Orchestra and Joe Loss and this kind of stuff, you know, been recorded weeks before or months before. And so when a record was played, when an actual record was played, regardless of whether it was brilliant or not, it was incredibly exciting because it sounded like a record. And that is the thing that in my books, I keep going back to this point that I was born in the world where people – I was born in 1950, and that's a world where people did not recognize any difference between music and records. I intuited as I grew up, first of all via children's favorites and then later via the Beatles and all that stuff, was that there was a fundamental difference. And people say to me, oh, you must be really passionate about music. And I say, well, actually, I'm not at all. I'm really passionate about records. Different thing.
Yes, yeah.
Different thing. It's like the difference between, you know, film and theatre or, you know, film and novels. They're kind of different forms, you know. So, you know, radio was, it was still the place where you were going to get to hear something. And so if you heard something in those days, and, you know, I can well remember hearing We Can Work It Out and Day Tripper. Is that 66?
It's end of 65, yeah.
So it's 65. And I can remember sitting in the front room of my parents' house and hearing they were going to play both sides of this record. And this was such a rare case because you happened to be there at the beginning.
Wow.
Because, you know, most of the time when you heard a record, you switched on the radio and it was already playing. And so you were partly delighted and partly disappointed. You see, I missed the beginning because you were never going to hear it again for weeks.
Yeah.
That was the deal. So when I heard We Can Work It Out, Day Tripper, the first time, I was very aware of the fact that I was trying to just inhale it so that I could hold it in my head.
Yeah.
For the time that it would take for me to hear it again, which would be days later. Whereas fundamentally different experience, all entertainment nowadays, whether music or otherwise, is experienced knowing you can click the thing and hear it again.
Yeah. And just the soundtrack of your life day to day, you know, you go to a supermarket, there's music playing.
It's there all the time.
I guess at the time, maybe in the hipper boutiques in London, you'd hear music now and again, but the general ambience, there was no music.
Oh, no, no, not at all. And let me tell you, I was, you know, it was in Wakefield in Yorkshire, and those, you could not get farther away from the notion of a kind of Carnaby Street boutique ambience. You know, there wasn't, it was gents outfitters and all that kind of thing, you know, and that stuff. I mean, the golden rule about these memories is that things always, the things that in your head you think, oh, that's roughly when these things happened, they actually happened about 2 years later. That's generally the way memory works, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I was thinking, looking at this particular edition of the New Musical Express from June 17th, I was very interested in 1967 because it is that period where if you look back at it, and I think it's pretty much unique in popular music history, where stylistically, even if only superficially, stylistically, everything's changed in about 6 weeks.
Yes.
It was just absolutely astonishing. Everybody, you know, the Beatles get a mustache, and then 6 weeks later, everybody in the world suddenly thinks they have to have a mustache. Or they, you know, that you get in here that the feature where the Hollies are, you know, Graham Nash and Tony Hicks are representing the different poles of the Hollies, you know, which has always particularly interested me. I would love the Hollies. Saw the Hollies a few times. Oh. And you know, the Hollies were a brilliant live band, really good live band. But there was something about the Hollies that was a little bit kind of end of the pier, you know, a little showbiz, and a bit shiny floor, you know, all that expression nobody used at the time.
Yeah.
And they came from the same, you know, they came from the north like the Beatles. They formed round about the same time like the Beatles. They signed for the same record company as the Beatles. They turned out loads of hit singles like the Beatles, but they never made that graduation. And you can feel in this piece in 1967 that Graham Nash just desperately wants them to be something that they are not.
Yeah.
You know, and he can't really express what he wants them to be. You know, he says, I think it'd be really good if we did a concert with us and Donovan and Ravi Shankar. And you think, crikey, most of the people going along to see the Hollies in 1967 were not looking for for ragas or anything like that, you know. But that was the way he saw it, you know. He always felt he should have been in the Beatles, really, which is a kind of sad thing, really.
Yeah.
He never, it strikes me, he never got over it at all. And the conversation with so many of his bands, all the way through this issue, you know, Procol Harum are in there, and, you know, the Hollies, Dave D, Dosey, make a dish.
Yeah.
All that. Invariably, the conversation comes back to haircuts and clothing. That suddenly everybody, and it is amazing to me when I go back and look at records made in that year, that everybody had to have a member who had a kind of Charlie Chan mustache, or somebody who wore a kind of caftan or some skull cap or something. And it's kind of tipped on the top of what was just your basic standard mid-60s play all the hits, Freddie and the Dreamers type, go on Malcolm or Wise, go on, I don't know, Tony the Night at the London Palladium. Suddenly there's this frosting of kind of weirdness over the top of it.
Yeah.
And it's really interesting. And it's there's all kinds of giveaways in this issue. There's a news item about the Beach Boys have decided, and they've decided at the last minute, they're not going to play this upcoming festival at Monterey. And that then became, that was the road not taken for the Beach Boys. That where they spent years regretting that. Now, had they turned up, there's no guarantee they would have gone down terribly well, you know. And yeah, you must have seen the Monterey Pop Festival film. It's really interesting because that takes place in the middle of this time. And so you get Jimi Hendrix doing Wild Thing and setting fire to his guitar and all that kind of stuff. And then you get Otis Redding.
Oh,
and Otis Redding feels he has to say, this is the love crowd, isn't it? This is the Love Crab.
Thank you so much. Right now, we'd like for you to kind of, we're going to slow it down this time and sing a soulful number. This song is a song that, you know, we all ought to sing sometime. You know? This is the Love Crowd, right? We all love each other, don't we? Am I right? Let me hear you say yeah, man. All right.
Because I'd said that there was hardly any coverage of pop music in the mainstream media, but there was a lot of coverage of what we now regard as flower power, psychedelia, the Summer of Love. And let's not forget, during the Summer of Love, nobody knew it was the Summer of Love. You know? But Otis Redding had intuited this, you know, he'd come out there to California, and he was a guy who normally played, you know, pretty much the chitlin circuit, and... and then played overseas as well. But going to California and in front of a load of people wearing heart-shaped sunglasses and flowers behind their ear, felt he had to kind of say something about this, you know.
When you say it was going so quickly, there's an old copy of Top of the Pops from December. It's the Christmas 67 show. And there's a brief section in there where people are, they're just asking various pop stars and DJs what they thought of the Summer of Love. And almost all of them are saying, well, it's only for a few weeks, isn't it? And they're completely dismissing it by December of the same year.
Well, yeah, it's funny that, isn't it? Really? Yes.
But what about 1967? What happened to flower power? It came, it went, and it wilted very hard indeed. So let's have a little discussion now on flower power for some very... shall we say, rather important people.
Right. The message and the philosophy to come out of flower power is much more significant and probably will be more lasting than the music itself.
Well, flower power, as far as this country was concerned, came and went.
Flower power wasn't really my scene.
Flower, well, it's made everything smell nice, I suppose.
Me? You're joking.
The flowers have withered and died. The commercial aspect's gone, and nobody loves anybody anymore.
I think Scott McKenzie was just a pretty record which was talking about San Francisco, which all the journalists and everyone said, oh, well, this is what it's all about. Well, I don't know, because I never went there.
We'll now move on to a song that's become a standard. It's much better to write a standard than a song just goes into hit parade and then suddenly disappears. Songs like Man and a Woman, Somewhere My Love, never went into the charts. But they saw more records and more sheet music over the years than anything else together. But occasionally, a song goes into the charts. Goes into the charts and becomes a standard. And this is one of them. White a Shade of Pale, as performed by the Procol Harum.
White a Shade of Pale is at number one. And that's a really significant moment.
Do you remember hearing that for the first time? That must have blown
you away. I'd be lying if I said I can remember the specific occasion. But I can remember being, like everybody, just obsessed with it. And I bought it. I've still got it on the DRAM label. And just played it endlessly like everybody did. I think even in the gossip column of this issue of the NME, it says that Spike Milligan is playing a copy in his dressing room all the time. And it became a kind of record that everybody agreed was amazing and is a fantastic record, but nobody could ever tell you what it was about at all. And I think still to this day, I've got to tell you what it's about. Is it a mood? Yes. Was it a very significant hinge moment in pop music? Yes. What does it mean? I have no idea. I'm not sure Keith Reid or whoever wrote the lyrics or whatever. I'm not sure they were there.
Yeah.
You know, but the point was, it felt, well, it wasn't Carrie Anne. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't regular pop music. And I suppose if you could make a point for saying, the thing that starts with the White a Shade of Pale is not psychedelia, it's indie. Indie starts there, which is kind of, I've got a head full of weird ideas, and I'm just gonna let them all out there. And if you don't get it, you don't get it.
Yes. Yeah.
And that is still the kind of animating spirit of indie to this day, it seems to me. And so you could say that kind of indie has lasted longer than kind of chirpy guitar pop music lasted. Yes. You know that these groups went on to have, in the case of Procol Harum, one way or another, really long careers. And of course, the weird thing with Procol Harum is that, you know, that they spent the subsequent 50 years going in and out of court, arguing about, you know, who authored the Bach intro and all that kind of thing. There's also a news item or gossip item in this issue about how Jacques Lussier goes to see them and goes to see Procol Harum when they're playing show. Because Jacques Lussier at the time was very well known for doing jazz versions of Bach. And would appear on telly all the time.
I think Kenny Everett used to use those, didn't he?
Very probably.
Some of his sketches, as I seem to recall.
Very probably. And I think it was probably, there was a famous cigar commercial about Hamlet cigars that was soundtracked by the sound of Jacques Lussier playing Air on a G-string, which, of course, is what's supposed to be the thing at the beginning of White as Shade of Pale, you know. But anyway, they spent years arguing about that. You also see it in this issue, because it's the editors of the NME, and I mean, I think it was pretty underdeveloped as compared to how it became later on. You know, this was the NME edited, well, it wasn't even called the NME. It was edited by Andy Gray. And he would have Keith Oltham, who I knew Keith Oltham. Keith Oltham only died the other week, you know, went on to be a big PR. And, you know, it was very much done like a newspaper. It was, you know, there's not great long features. But the one thing they're making a point of doing is getting the Monkees on the cover of absolutely every issue they can. Because there's the other thing. You know, 1967 is the high watermark of the Monkees, it seems to me, in my recollection. You know, that I remember buying Last Train to Clarksville. I think it was that one, or was it the one after? I can't remember. One of the first two or three singles. Mm. On the same day that I bought Hey Joe by Jimi Hendrix.
Wow.
You know, and at the time, it's not remarkable at all. Yeah, but afterwards there came a kind of schism, you know what I mean?
Especially after the tour, or during the tour.
Yeah, and you get Monterey, and you get a different way of doing things. And also at this stage, and it's remarked upon in one interview I was reading in the issue, I can't remember who it was with, they say, well, it appears that the Beatles and the Rolling Stones have stopped touring. What do you think of that, you know?
Yes.
And, of course, that would have been how it appeared, you know. And nobody was surprised that the Beatles had stopped touring, because you could see that they would do that. But the Rolling Stones, I don't think it was regarded as an official cessation of touring. It was just, they were having a bit of a moment with Brian Jones, I think, and, you know, couldn't decide between doing things in America and doing things in the UK.
Yeah.
Because then they were off doing their Satanic Majesties. And of course, that's the other thing. If you want to go back to that moment in the mid 67 where everybody did it, is that, you know, Beatles released Sgt. Pepper in May, I think, and everybody, almost without exception, immediately goes off and tries to do their own version.
Yeah.
You know, the Rolling Stones, the Hollies. You know, I've even got a Four Seasons album from around about the same time. You know, they all rushed off to do concept records. You know, all of which had tracks about gentlemen wearing pinstripes cycling to work, or, you know, things, you know, old-fashioned Edwardian attitudes, and then songs featuring small children voicing, you know, spoken sections in the middle. Just everybody did that.
Yeah.
Because it was suddenly seen as that's the way. And going back to Graham Nash, I really feel for Graham Nash. He heard Sgt. Pepper before it came out. And he's quoted as saying, if only we could have seen that, you know. As if to say, if the Hollies could have seen what they did, they would have done it. No, they wouldn't, no. Graham. No, they wouldn't. They're just not that kind of people. Not those kind of people at all, you know. And you wouldn't have done it on your own either, because you're not that kind of person, you know.
Yeah, because a month later, because obviously they released Evolution, and there was a press conference, and all of the Hollies were suited and booted apart from Graham, and he had a full-length psychedelic yellow patterned nightshirt. And but I'm guessing this is after he's met Mama Cass, who introduced him to...
Yeah, so probably is after that. And well, he also met Joni Mitchell, didn't he, quite early on?
Oh, gosh, yeah.
Because there's a wonderful story. He meets Joni Mitchell there. They're on tour in Canada, I think. And Joni Mitchell comes to his hotel. And if you want an illustration of the fathomless ego of musicians, she doesn't play him one of her songs. She plays him 10. Imagine that. What a move that is, you know. Oh, you write songs, do you? Okay, well, this one's called Both Sides Now. Or whatever. So have you done anything like that? This one's called Songs to a Seagull or whatever. But anyway, yeah, he was... And, of course, the vision of him turning up for a press conference wearing a caftan while the rest of them are all wearing kind of Peter Pell suits or whatever is like an installment of The Likely Lads that nobody made, you know. You think, what a fantastic comedy that would be, you know.
What are you wearing, Terry?
Yeah. Of course, the other thing in here that I was very taken by, apart from you got the ad for See Emily Play, which is Pink Floyd. Is that their second single? I think it is.
Was
that
the first one, Arnold
Lane? After Arnold Lane, yes. Is you've got the advert. Well, it's quite a big advert, actually. It says Liberty, and it's got the Liberty, the Statue of Liberty. And it says, Liberty wants talent. Artists, stroke composers, singer musicians to form a new group. Call or write Ray Williams for appointment. Call or write for appointment. That takes you back. Write for appointment.
Yeah.
Or send audition tape or disc to Albemarle Street, London W1. And he's even got the telephone number. And that is the ad that Elton John and Bernie Taupin both responded to.
Wow.
Neither of them got anywhere, but I think Ray Williams put them on to each other, because one guy could write tunes but couldn't write words. Other guy could write words, couldn't write tunes.
Yeah.
And so that's it.
And that's hidden away just amongst all this other, you know, See Emily Play has just been released, and there's that as well.
Well, yeah. And of course, it is wonderful. You get a vision of how the chart was. Here's a top 10 from June 14th, 1967. And I'm going to read from number 10. I'm going to go down. I'm going to go down, as Alan Freeman would have said, the uppers and the downers and the hanging around us. And number 10, Finchley Central by the New Vaudeville Band, who I think probably at the time were managed by Peter Grant, I think, you know. Led Zeppelin and so forth. And a number 9... illustrating how important a seam this always was in British pop music from very early on, is Arthur Conley's Sweet Soul Music. Those kind of hard-hitting Stax Vault Atlantic records were, everybody loved them. Absolutely everybody loved them. Because don't forget at this point, Otis Redding, Otis Blue, I think if you probably look in the album chart, it's probably still there. Because Otis Blue was a massive hit in the UK. 4 years. Anyway, so next, OK by Dave D. Dozy Beacon Titch, which I can't quite remember. No. But the interview with Dave D elsewhere in the issue, because Dave D used to be a policeman.
Yes.
And of course, I met Dave D, you know, because Dave D for years worked as a kind of, well, I think he's a managing director of Warner Brothers or something. Yeah, he was a plugger, basically. You know, he stopped being a musician. He was a plugger. But he's quoted in this issue where they're talking about, you know, love and mustaches and so forth. He's talking about how the police occasionally have to deal with unruly teenage girls. And now policemen, well, you just slap them.
Oh, dear.
It actually says that. It's amazing. Wow. And number eight is the Beach Boys version of Then I Kissed Her. You know, God knows that. Yeah, the kind of strange pattern of the releases of Beach Boys records. No rhyme nor reason to it whatsoever. You know, there's good vibrations, and then the next thing you know, it's Then I Kissed Her.
Well, this was Capitol doing what they do, and they really didn't want it out. And this is just after this, they announced they were going to launch Brother Records.
Oh, right, okay.
Because they, and I think they sued Capitol as well for $250,000.
Well, they're the worst. You see, the Beatles are a wonderful example of a group just blessed by unbelievable good fortune. And the Beach Boys are an example of the absolute opposite. You know, if anything could go wrong in the Beach Boys' career, it went wrong. Absolutely. And they all just sat there going, I don't know what's happened here. You know, managed by their father and then their mates and, you know, just all over the place. Anyway, so Then I Kissed Her. Then the Mamas and Papas, dedicated to the one I love. Carrie Ann by the Hollies. The Happening by the Supremes. Again, The Happening. You know, it's that idea of, It's somewhere there's a world full of zany parties and artists where Peter Sellers is wearing a caftan, you know, and somebody's cycling across a canvas or something.
Yeah.
The Happening was that idea. Then number four, Waterloo Sunset. Oh. Number three, the Tremolos, Silence is Golden. Number two, There Goes My Everything by Engelbert Humperdinck.
His dinkle's always being humbled.
And then number one, A Whiter Shade of Pale. You know, it's well, isn't it right to say, didn't Penny Lane, Strawberry Fields not actually get to number one in the UK because it was divided across two? Is that right? And I think it was Ken Dodd's tears that kept them off. if you looked at it in that way, it was Ken Dodd's tears.
But I think Release Me, wasn't it the biggest selling single of 67 or
something? I was Release Me. Okay. Oh, really right. Good. Yes. It was that. But, right. Yeah. But anyway, what I was saying was that there was in that copy of The Enemy, this mix of kind of far out hipsters, there's Vanilla Fudge, whatever. And then there's a review of Frank Ifield in his Summer Season. He's just opened his Summer Season in Blackpool or whatever.
Yeah.
And he turns up and he does a medley of his hits and he announces that his wife is expecting a baby, you know. So there's still, you can still smell the Tin Pan Alley in this edition of the New Musical Express.
Hold the line, I have a call for you.
Shall I continue ringing?
Be a telephone girl. It's a great life.
Hey, telephone girl. Hey, 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 telephone girl. When I call for you, I can call for you. Got a groovy job, it's a call for you. Hey, hey, telephone girl.
Be a telephone girl. Apply to your local telephone manager or head postmaster.
In the teasers column at the back, which is where all the shorts used to go, all the just little bits of gossip, and they were all separated by three dots, were they? I think years later, The Enemy, I may be wrong, turned it into a format which they just called three dots. you know, because it was so, and that was an idea that came out. I think if you go back, it comes from Variety magazine in the United States. You know, that idea of just doing fast stuff. Yeah. And but anyway, if you go through that fast stuff, you get a kind of stuff about Steve Winwood, and then you get stuff about some publisher's wife is expecting a baby or whatever. Somebody's just had a silver wedding, you know. So it still feels in many ways like an old-fashioned trade magazine.
Yeah.
You know, it's still got that underpinning, you know, and it's still got, you know, the ads from publishers. Because for years, don't forget, you could buy the front page of these things.
Absolutely,
you know, EMI would say, oh, pie or whatever. All right, Petula Clark's got a new single. We'll buy the front page of the Enemy. And it would be an advert, you know. Yeah. But here you've got also interesting examples of crossover or, you know, attempted crossover, which is you got a sudden rash, obviously, of cover versions of Beatles songs off Sgt. Pepper. One of them here is When I'm 64, done by Kenny Ball and his jazz band.
Yay. You know?
Because, you know, Kenny Ball, just before the Beatles came along, it had been all trad jazz, you know.
Yes.
And, of course, that wasn't long before. That was 4 years before.
Yes.
You know. I mean, the rate of change is something nobody can imagine nowadays. Simply can't, you know. If you listen to a record made 10 years ago, now it sounds the same as if it was made yesterday.
Absolutely,
if you listen to a record made
yeah.
20 years ago, it sounds the same. In 1967, anything that was made in 1963 sounded like it came from the moon.
Yeah.
Because and you go back to your records, and the thing I always find myself thinking about, particularly 1965, 66, and 67, every week brought a new hit record that didn't sound like anything you'd ever heard before.
Mm.
Not anything. They all had a new, I wouldn't even call it a gimmick. It was just, they can make a sound that they never made before. You know, White as a Shade of Pale, nobody had ever made a record sound like White as a Shade of Pale before. Not ever, you know. I don't know. You get See My Friends by the Kinks, or the Drone, all those kind of things. And so there would be a feeling that, have you heard this record by whoever it is? Well, you've got to hear it. And it was like, that's what people said to each other. You've got to hear it.
Yes.
And what that meant was, it'll be something the like of which you've never heard before.
But I think the key thing, as you say, there's no delineation. I mean, you've got Engelbert Humperdinck and the Shadows, along with Jimi Hendrix, Pink Floyd, and then you've got Vince Hill. And there's no rhyme nor reason. They can't seem to understand at this point the difference, as you say, between rock
except
light entertainment.
Yeah, I'm not sure that they... I'm not sure it's always a good thing that you do recognise the difference, really, you know. I mean, you end up with, you know, Mark and I were talking the other day about Six Music started this thing, Indie Forever, haven't they?
Oh, yes.
Where basically you can be guaranteed that for the rest of your life, you will never hear anything that doesn't sound like the Verve and Oasis. you know, so that's where adventurousness ended up, you know. In the snuggest cul-de-sac you can ever possibly imagine, you know. Whereas in those days, everything was, you know, it was all together. And, you know, Radio 1 was launched in late summer, but it still turned into Radio 2, I think, halfway through the day. I think it was Radio 1 at breakfast or something, and then it was Jimmy Young, or it was probably a different person at that point later on.
Yeah.
I tell you what, I couldn't help notice here, in the album reviews, and they're very short album reviews, just near the front of the book, is that they got a record by Shaney Wallace. And Shaney Wallace was a kind of cabaret singer. And she was about to become quite famous because she just finished filming Oliver, where she played Nancy in Oliver, the you know, the production of the film of Oliver, which is a huge hit. Oliver Reed and Jack Wilde and Mark Lester and Ron Moody and so forth. She played Nancy. She was a kind of cabaret singer. And her album was reviewed there. And nothing happened with the album. But I did happen to notice the other day that she popped up winning, although not getting broadcast, on Britain's Got Talent.
What?
At the age of 92.
Wow.
And you can go and look at her on YouTube. And there she is. She's brilliant, actually. She's really good. She married an American, went and lived and worked in Vegas and whatever for years. And just thought, no, I'm going to see if I've still got it. And she entered Britain's Got Talent. She was really good.
Did they know the backstory?
Well, they always claim not to. I don't know. I've no idea at all.
Yeah.
Make up your own mind. You'd have to go and look at it. But I did think it was extraordinary.
That
she was still there. The four kings of Emma are sitting stately on the floor. There are birds out on the sidewalk and a valet at the door. He reminds me of a penguin with few and plaster hair. There's talcum powder on the letter and the birthday boy is there. Why don't you cut your hair? Why don't you live up there? Why don't you do what I do, see what I feel when I care? Of course, there's also single reviews. Oh. The lead single is of course Monkeys, alternate title. Now, you probably know more about this than I do, but wasn't that when they put it out in America? Didn't they actually call it Randy Scouse Git?
Yeah,
I think they did. Whereas in Britain, it couldn't be called that because this is a really interesting kind of reversal of the normal relationship between America and the United Kingdom. Which is they're terribly prudy and we're not. Whereas the reason it was called Randy Scouse Git, and there may be people listening who are not aware of this, is that Till Death Us Do Part was the big comedy favourite of the UK at the time, which of course featured Warren Mitchell as Alf Garner and Danny Nicol as his wife and Una Subbs as their daughter. And Anthony Booth, later the father of Cherie Blair.
Yeah.
Sorry, is this too much? Tony tangents. But anyway, as the young layabout son-in-law, who Alf used to dismiss by calling him a Randy Scouse Git, because he came from Liverpool. And the Monkees were somehow inspired to write this song by the idea of Randy Scouse Git. And obviously the BBC and whoever said, well, you can't call it that in the UK. So hence it's called Alternate Title.
Which is just the best title for a single ever.
I suppose it is. Was that ELO record that is called in the United States, it's called No Answer. Is it the first or the second ELO record? I think it might be the second. And the reason it's called No Answer is it was just called ELO2, I think, in the UK. And somebody from the record company in the United States was given the job of ringing up or finding out what the title was. And she couldn't get through, so she put No Answer. And that's what it's called in the United States.
Yeah. Super.
It's a good story, isn't it?
Yeah. But, of course, yeah, we'll turn this up from Headquarters, which is probably my second favourite Monkees album.
Really?
Beautiful album.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I always had the problem with them.
Yeah, at the time, did you have the anti?
Well, I quite liked, you know. As I say, I bought last year a Train to Clarksville, and I'm a believer or whatever. And I never bought an album. Never bought a Monkees album, and would never have bought a Monkees album because they were the people who liked the Monkees at the time. Were a distinctly younger group, and they were distinctly female. And I probably, from my position of massive maturity at the age of 17, I probably looked down on this, you know. And I didn't dislike. I tell you what got me back into the Monkees, and this is well, I'd never been a Monkees fan, but I was a big Mike Nesmith fan. Was Zigzag magazine years later. did a two-part, really detailed interview with Mike Nesmith where he talked about everything he'd done. And that was really interesting. So I probably I probably retraced my steps when in 1974 or whenever it was that happened. But also, going back to your point about the mix between show business and psychedelia, among the guests on the Billy Cotton Band show were Procol Harum.
Yes.
Billy Cotton, you know, the father of, the grandfather of Fern Cotton, isn't that right?
Or, yeah.
God, probably even great-grandfather, I don't know. I'm not up to the Cotton family genealogy, but he was the kind of, you know, he used to, the Billy Cotton Band show, which always used to start with him going, wakey, wakey.
Yeah.
Which is no doubt a joke that meant something to people who saying World War didn't mean much to me.
Right.
But there, in the middle of that, he must have said, you know, Mr. Turn from the Black and White Minstrels. Because did they start the Billy Cotton Banjo? Maybe I've got them wrong.
Well, probably, I guess.
But
they
probably would have appeared to it. So it's not impossible that the Black and White Minstrels, which featured, you know, white singers, you know, black makeup, would have appeared on the same program as Procol Harum, who were a bunch of guys from Southend, suddenly dressed up like kind of running a kind of gimmicky Chinese restaurant somewhere in Soho. It's just an absolute, you know, it's Britain, it's the dressing up box dimension of British pop music, which is never to be underrated. There is always, people like the idea, dress up as a cowboy, dress up as a whatever it is, you know. It's there in Dexys Midnight Runners. It's there in loads of other groups. You know,
yes.
It's a very strong thing in the UK. And of course, you've got, you know, Todd the Pops was there at that time, you know. So if you appeared, you know, playing your would be psychedelic single, you'd wear your would be psychedelic clothes at the same time. Because in Holly's case, this must have been just before King Midas in Reverse, mustn't it? Because that was what happened, is that King Midas in Reverse was Graham's bid for the Hollies to be taken seriously. And listen, it's a brilliant record, but it was not a big hit. And so at that point, Alan Clark said, okay, we've tried all that stuff, let's go back to Jennifer Eccles and, you know, fake whistling on tracks and all that kind of stuff. And then Graham left. And I actually saw them. I remember seeing the Hollies, and it must have been 1968, the first part of 1968, at the Battley Variety Club. I saw them on stage.
Wow.
And they were, listen, I'd seen them before. They were, let me say, the Hollies were a really good live group, really good. Better than the Beatles, because people were not screaming out. I mean, you know, they could hear themselves.
Yes.
And the harmonies were, you know, they'd started off as a kind of Everly's-type group with Graham and Alan, and then grafted on all the rest of them over the years. And God, they were good. They were really good. And so I saw them in Battle Variety Club. And Graham, I've read a lot about this later. You know, they went back, they were staying at some hotel outside Leeds, where Graham used to go back to his room and smoke a joint, puffing it out the window and kind of wafting it away. And then sit down to write Mariska Cash Express or whatever, wishing he was with his hip mates in California rather than having to schlep his arse around the Battley Variety Club.
I think the Hollies very much like Enid Blyton characters, you know, Five Go Mad in whatever.
Yeah.
And, he's the naughty George.
He was the one who just he thought it was a cuckoo in the nest. He did Graham Nash. Graham Nash in the Hollies is like every drama that you saw on TV on films in those days. It was set in the north of England, and always had one member who'd been to university.
Yes,
and had come back and thought they were a bit better than all.
Sauce, can you?
No.
Oh, but I got it specially. You always loved it when you was little.
Did I?
What's up?
Nothing.
What's that snooty expression for, then?
Well, what snooty expression?
That new pullover's turned out a treat. Mind you, I'll not knit you another one in that colour, though. Navy blue plays the devil with my eyes.
Don't they do this at college, then?
I bet they don't eat in the shirt sleeves either.
Oh, what do you mean?
Oh, I've been noticing you looking at me.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Oh, yes, you do. We're not good enough.
Look, I never said a word and he starts.
Look, Dad, can't we have 1 meal in peace for a change?
Now, you know he doesn't like to hear you call me Dad. It's common.
Oh, give over the pair of you. Be back at it again, something off.
That's what comes of doing that rotten job of yours. I bet you don't tell your high and mighty pals that, eh, Ken?
What?
Where your mother works.
Well, it's no secret. She works in a hotel kitchen. If anyone asks me, of course I will.
What's got into you, Frank? You're edging up for six. What's up with you then?
Go on, blame me. I would. It's him. You better watch out, either. He'll be having you change into evening gowns with your meal next.
I was only discussing this yesterday with my family. We I was saying, I remember seeing the first ever Coronation Street, which is, what, 61, is it? So I remember the first introduction of Ken Barlow as the character who'd been to university and had come back. And we, family meal at our house, you know, all their children, grandchildren, whatever, we're having to look up whether Ken Barlow was still in Coronation Street. He is still in Coronation Street. He's 91 or whatever.
He's still there.
He's still there. He can't be. He can't appear very often, but he is still
there. Oh, bless him.
That's, you know, that's a heck of a thing. Mind you know, lots of these... You know, some of these groups are still there one way or another, you know.
Yeah.
It's got a piece here about P.P. Arnold going on tour with the Knights, you know. Because Mark and I spoke to P.P. Arnold not long ago. You know, she's still on tour.
She is.
Know?
Yeah, I really you want know, to see it, her.
If the health has, you know, we talked to Graham Nash not that long ago, you know. You know, if they've been fortunate with their health, you know, they can do it. And, of course, nobody envisaged that at all, you know, that it would last anything like this long. We were talking to Peter Frampton of The Herd are in here, you know. Yes. There's an advert for you can book The Herd via Kennedy Street Enterprises. You know. he was telling us about how, and this must have been 1969 that it happened with The Herd, that they had to, that they were performing on Streatham Ice Rink, on the rink. And they had to kind of bolt back to the dressing room, chased by screaming girls who literally want to rend their garments.
Yeah.
And you imagine the members of the herd slipping.
Yeah. Well, it's not just like the Stones and Paul McCartney, because, I mean, Andy Bowne and Peter Frampton have both got new albums.
Well, there you go.
And Mike Darbo has got a new album out as well.
Is it really? Okay. Yeah absolutely. Yes. It's really interesting when you talk to some of these people. Who were we talking to the other day? I can't remember. Oh, God, it can't come out of my head. You must have had these. Well, you do the Zoom recordings with people. You set up a Zoom. You say, can we do it via Zoom? Me and they, yeah, fine, okay. And then you only see them when people appear on Zoom. You know, yeah. And when people say appearing on Zoom, it's a new form of human interaction. You don't see them coming. You suddenly, there they are, yes. Right on top of you. And sometimes you get a bit of a shock. You know? And then other times you think, oh, my God. And who we do? We did Leo Sayer. Look, fantastic. Absolutely spookily, you know, fantastic. We did Steve Hackett out of Genesis.
Wow.
Now, Steve Hackett would have joined Genesis in, what, 67? I said, he would have done this year, wouldn't he?
Yeah.
He looks fantastic. You know? And I don't think he looks fantastic because he's had loads of work done or anything like that. Although, you know, golden rule is good work, nobody can see it, you know. But it's amazing how many of them still look absolutely fantastic.
Yeah.
It's extraordinary to see.
But talking of, I mean, you were saying that the Nice, because obviously around this time there was some adverts for the 7th National Jazz Pop
show.
Royal Windsor Racecourse. And obviously Pink Floyd had to pull out and the Nice had to cover for them. A copy of the poster of this on my wall. It's fantastic, you know, proper old-fashioned 60s style poster. But yeah, and Pink Floyd's name is right, you know, front and center.
They weren't there at all. But I think that happened a lot in those days. You know, I can people got double booked. You know, they used to very often, they would play two, even three shows in a night, you know, bands. They were, you know, nobody ever, here's one of the points that has become clear, talking to venerable, you know, rock stars who started in the 60s. Did you ever stay in a hotel? And they all say, no, not ever. We just got in the back of the van and we went back to London. It didn't matter where we were coming from, what time of the day or night, that's what you did. You know, nobody knew. There was nowhere to stay. The great novelty of UK acts coming back from the United States was, and the reason they all wrote songs about it was, they'd found a place called Holiday Inn. And they thought, wow, that's so exciting. It's a sort of motel. It's kind of groovy. And you got a big room. Yeah. There was nowhere like that in Britain. Nowhere. There were posh hotels, and then there were seaside boarding houses, and there was nothing in between at all. I still have the time to take this opportunity. Time for me to look at you, and you to look at me.
There's a big old article here about the Yellow Submarine movie as well. There's an interview with Al Brodax.
Yes, yes.
But they describe it as going to be the Beatles' musical fantasia. The songs they have been recorded for us this week are brilliant, incredible. They're using sounds I've never heard.
That's the thing. Nothing sounded like it had sounded in the past. Nothing at all. Even kind of... You know, if you take a record like When I'm 64, which is deliberately pastiching a kind of, I don't know, probably never really existed, a kind of 1930s dance band sound, it still sounded oddly modern, you know what I mean?
Yes.
Because suddenly records, and this is what George Martin's genius was, records could take you places. You know, it's sound pictures. You know, that's what it was all about. It took you from one place to another in the process of different tracks. But even amongst this, you've got Mantovani and his orchestra. Their new single is "You Only Live Twice." I always loved the idea. There's something deeply poignant about bands who get advertised and never make it in any shape or form. You know, And I have to think, what are they doing nowadays? You know, so along with Mantovani, this is Decca advert. Two of each, doing every single day. Immediate had a band called Twice As Much, didn't they? They had the duo. And then there's an act called Wishful Thinking. Did they become somebody? Now that sounds as if it rings a bell. And then Peter Lee Sterling. So Mantovani have recorded You Only Live Twice. Peter Lee Sterling has recorded You Don't Live Twice. Decca must have thought it was worth a go, you know.
Because Julie Rogers did an early demo of You Only Live Twice. And it was a completely different song. It was a John Barry composition.
Oh, really?
But completely different piece of music. And I think there are some financial difficulties. So Nancy Sinatra was called in to help financially. I don't want to go there, what happened there. But she did, and then they basically said, sorry, Julie, you're out. And then they got John Barry to rewrite the song that we now know. But it's a completely different song. It's really good, actually.
I'm sure. I suppose that's what it's what's bound to happen if you've got to write a song called that, haven't you? Because that's the title of the movie. You know, it's a, I think all bands should have to do that. Actually, it's a brilliant discipline, isn't it? You've got to write to order. It's like Hard Day's Night. You know, Hard Day's Night is a brilliant record. I mean, the album as well as the single. The single is a brilliant record. Made completely to order. You know, what are we calling this film? We're calling it Hard Day's Night. Okay, we're calling it that.
<Off you go. laughs>
I need a song, and I need it tomorrow. And he effectively did it, didn't he? John Lennon, not the world's most motivated man at the best of times. You know, first of all, well, now I'm going to get there ahead of Paul. I've got to make sure I've got this one.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
And comes back and they record it. And I always think one of the great aspects of those Beatles records in the mid-60s is you can feel the hurry. You can sense the excitement that's driven them to write it. Like, we're writing a song for a film we just named yesterday, and we're recording it tomorrow. And it's going to be done. And that's just a brilliant thing. And then the listeners are going to hear it, 2 weeks later? So that's kind of urgency that, you simply, you haven't got it, you haven't had it in pop music for absolutely years, you know.
Yes.
This was the hurly-burly of those days.
You must leave now, take what you need, you think will last. But whatever you wish to keep, you'd better grab it fast. He understands you're orphan with his gun, crying like a fire in the sun. Look out, the saints are coming through, and it's all over now, baby blue.
There's an article in they've got America Calling. It's all the news from America. And there's one here, Bob Dylan's first and only movie so far called Don't Look Back.
Don't Look Back, yeah.
It's currently being screened at an underground theatre in San Francisco.
Yeah, it would be.
Yeah, but it's outdrawing other films such as Sound of Music and Blow Up.
You see, that would have been...
There's a few films.
I didn't see like Don't Look Back until... Certainly didn't see it in 67. I don't think you could see it in 67. Certainly not if you're in Yorkshire. And I think if I'd seen it in 1967, I don't think I would have known what to make of it at all. Because you were still used to things that had a kind of certain form to them, you know. They were introduced and then they were back announced. And you knew where you were going.
Yes.
The whole thing about Don't Look Back is you don't know where you're going at all. You're in the back of the car and it's, what the hell is going on here, you know? And that's what makes it a really good film. It is a fantastic film. But I'm sure if 17-year-old me had seen it in 1967, I would have found it really odd.
Did you see Blow Up at the time?
I did see Blow Up at the time and... yes, and I still don't claim to understand Blow Up to this day. But the thing that made Blow Up really appealing, that is underestimated in retrospect, is sex. You got people taking their clothes off. And you didn't get much of that. You know what I mean? And so there was, you know, David Hemmings disporting himself with Jane Birkin, isn't it? It's Jane Birkin. And we all looked at that. Every chap in my sixth form looked at that and thought, that's what I want to do. I want to go to London. I want to be a photographer. I suppose I'll need to get a camera. Because there he is, driving around London. He's in a convertible Rolls Royce, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, there was a whole host of like things like Here We Go Around the Mulberry Bush was a similar.
Oh, I love that film. I loved him. Here We Go Around the Mulberry Bush, which he's made this year, I think. Did it come out in 67, 68? Written by Hunter Davis, based on a book by Hunter Davis, starring Barry Evans and Judy Geeson, with music by Traffic and Spencer Davis and so forth. And, you know, it was all about... that. You see, that's the other thing. You know, TV producers, when they recreate 1967, suddenly everybody's got flared trousers and is smoking marijuana. Not true. Neither thing true at all. Flared trousers were not available to most of the UK until 1969. Fact. Simple as that. You know, marijuana was not available to anybody. It was only available to about 150 people in the UK. you had to find it. But the thing that was really powerful about the kind of alternative society rock festival, do your own thing, was its association with sexual possibility. That was the thing. And if you go back and you looked at the newspapers, not the music papers, go and look at the newspapers. Go and look at the newspapers. What is the one thing you always see whenever they report a rock festival? It's not the bands. It's not the Hell's Angels. It's some girl taking a top off and it is festooned with beads or something. And suddenly, as far as the rest of the nation was gone, there is a world where that kind of thing takes place. Bloody hell, I'd like to go to that, you know, because that had been completely inconceivable 2-3 years later. In the world of Hard Day's Night, that was utterly inconceivable, you know. What's the interesting thing about Hard Day's Night? No sex.
Absolutely. Yeah. Deliberately so as well, yeah.
You know, this is the biggest entertainment sensation of the century. No sex.
Hello, this is Mike Mundy in Soho. We're on now the corner of Old Compton Street, and I'd like to take you into Lord Kitchener's Valet, which is one of the most in and one of the new move shops in London. This is the really new fashion. Lord Kitchener's Valet. Now, this is a strange name for a shop. Can you tell us exactly why this name was chosen?
Yeah, well, you know, Lord Kitchener was a general in 1914, 18 war or something. You know, he was the one who said, your country needs you.
Uh-huh.
But more or less, it just, you know, fits the style and the sort of period of the clothing. Uh-huh.
How long has this kind of fashion been going now?
Well, it's been roughly about 6 months.
About 6 months.
Yeah,
well, how long do you give it? How long do you think it'll last?
Well, it hasn't really started yet. I give it to really start catching on this summer and last through till next summer at least, you know. Mm-hmm. I should imagine about 2 years, 2-3 years.
Uh-huh.
But then again, there's always... We aren't only going to keep selling military stuff. We're going to sort of always buy different clothes. There'll always be mad clothes, something different. But we've
something completely outrageous.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And we always keep military stuff. But there's always people who have always worn military stuff.
I think a big part of learning... See, I want to learn... why I'm doing this, because I love the 60s, but I wasn't there. And I love speaking to people, because it's just this kind of mundane day-to-day stuff. Because on the page 10 and 11, there's some great adverts which really give you an overview. So you think it's the Flower Power era. So you've got the latest from I Was Lord Kitchener's Valet.
Lord Kitchener's Valet, yes.
Yeah.
It's military stuff, isn't it?
Yeah, wasn't it old stuff from the war that I think
some
they
acquired? Some of them, I don't think it might have been. You could, and actually, probably in 1967... In the winter of 1967, I did what every 17-year-old or 18-year-old would do.
Uh-oh.
I went to the Army and Navy store and I bought myself a military greatcoat.
Did you?
Absolutely everybody bought a military greatcoat because you buy them for next to nothing. They were Army surplus, whatever, RAF
yes.
or... I think Navy, yeah. And if you, and here's the secret. If you were, you know, 17 and, well, you couldn't quite do it because you were still at school, but as soon as you left school, you did it, which is grow your hair. If you could grow your hair, you're 17 years old, and you wore a military greatcoat, you look fabulous. You looked so cool. Yeah, the greatcoat was the big thing that I would have bought later that year. Yes, but in those days you had to send away. And of course, your ad for Lord Kitchener's Valet selling, you know, military-style tunics is directly opposite a recruitment ad from the British Army inviting you. It's decent pay and you're well treated. And, you know, because they were having to, you know, recruit because there was the outside chance they might get involved in the war in Vietnam.
Yeah. Well, national service had dropped as well. So.
Well, that stopped quite a few years earlier because that, again, going back to the Beatles, why the Beatles? It's because the end of national service. That's why the Beatles. Because before that, they wouldn't have been able to. They would have been packed off to, you know, BFPO 24, you know.
And again, the timing, it was like weeks, wasn't it, I think? Or...
Yeah, they were very close. Very close. Yeah. Yeah, Ringo must have somehow got onto the wire. Yeah. And yes, you get that mix here. There's also a piece new to the charts. There's also a piece about somebody called Aretha Franklin, who's described as a blues singer, which is not a designation I've ever heard in my life. You know, I've heard gospel, I've heard soul, I've heard divas and all that kind of stuff. But no, blues singers was how she was described at the time. But no, it's wonderful to see these things because, you know, the thing about, you know, old magazines and newspapers, you know, which I used to say at the time, and it's more the case now that you're looking at it in retrospect, is you read content at the same time as you read context. You know, you see things alongside other things. You get a feeling of the time, which you do not get from taking an isolated example, from reading one feature. You get it from scanning your eye, going across these things, and seeing the range of stuff, you know.
Yeah.
And it's a wonderful reminder of the great truth of the music business, which I think is often forgotten, which is nobody ever knows what they're doing, not ever. They're just floundering around trying to get the next hit. That's all they're trying to do.
Yeah.
And of course, in those days, hit records, you were trying to get four a year, weren't you, or something like that? You know, I interviewed Ray Davies, and Ray Davies, who had the greatest, you know, 15 top 20 records or something like that, all written on by himself. Mm. And he said, "Some people like inspiration. I need a deadline." You know? And you know, you can't imagine the pressure of that, you know.
Yeah.
They're all looking at you, mate.
Yes.
Your no good brother and whatever. You know. They're going, "Well, go on, come on, what have you come up with now? What's it called? Waterloo what?"
Yeah.
And it's an amazing thing that those guys managed to keep up with that stuff.
Music, that's our middle name. Music.
You can see clearly the joy you're getting going through these. Was your experience as a teenager reading these magazines, did you want the same experience when you launched Smash Hits?
There was quite a bit of that. Yeah, there's quite a few. As I look here, I'm looking at the lifelines of chart-topping Brutal Harem, where all the members, you know, talk about the names of their mothers and where they came from in Croydon or whatever, who their favourite jazz saxophonist is. When I took on Smash Hits, we deliberately reintroduced a lot of that stuff. You know, we called it personal file. We called it personal file Smash Hits. And I can remember sending, not an email, because there were no emails, a circular around to the press offices of all the record companies. And I was tongue-in-cheek. I said, "We're now trying to reverse the direction of music coverage entirely in direction of trivia." It's not really true, but you know, you were trying to put clear water between yourself and the enemy, which at the time was because you know the thing that people forget is the enemy around about the time that I was editing Smash Hits, or slightly earlier, had the same people on the cover. It was the Jam, it was Blondie and so forth, and then within a year it was Teen Suicide. it's like, "Oh, okay, you've given up that battle." You know. Anyway, so yes, we tried to, we reintroduced quite a few things, and the Smash Hits yearbook and all those sorts of, all those play things were very much inspired by our happy memories of reading the Record Mirror on the Enemy or whatever, which is, and because most of those things, when I go back to them now, I think, wow, they're not quite as good as I remember. But that's not their fault. You know, they were weaklies. They had limited tools at their disposal. You know, they were black and white, you know. But the fact that my memories are so warm says a lot about how important they were, you know. Massively important to British pop music. Hugely important. And, of course, the Americans don't have anything like that. Not part of their culture. It's not part of the culture at all. The idea that everybody who played a guitar or, you know, tried to play guitar would go and buy one of these things every Thursday and then literally read the print of it. Absolutely every last dot and comma they'd read. Because they were just hungry. And then they go back and read it again.
Yes.
You know, that's very formative on a nation, that is. And so that, you know, all those guys, what did you want out of life? I wanted to be an enemy, or I wanted to be on John Peel, or whatever. They wanted to be small steps. They didn't envisage that high point. You know, they just thought, God, get your record reviewed in the NME. That must be quite something. Or to be a jukebox jury or all those kind of things.
I think going through these, as I have been, I mean, New Musical Express is quite a dry, until the 70s, it's quite a dry, it's plain.
Until Alan Smith is the person who makes the difference with Alan Smith.
Yeah.
And then it's Nick after that. Yeah.
Yeah. I'd say the nearest to Smash Hits was probably Rave magazine.
Rave came from Ableist Girls, isn't it? That's the thing that apparent to me when I look at it now, which was not apparent to me at the time, because I did used to get it occasionally. But now I look at it and think, oh, God, it was Girls. That's what it was. It was Steve Marriott, Scott Walker, Peter Frampton, all those people. And it's ads for Miners Makeup.
Yeah.
That was the sell. Makes perfect sense. It didn't quite take off. It was just caught between Girls and the music press, I think, or whatever. And the NME and you know, Melody Maker is probably more in the lead at this point, 67, 68.
Yeah.
You know, so you got has Richard Williams joined? He probably has. You know, you got Richard Green and these kind of people.
Chris Welch,
yes. And, but because Melody Maker is coming from a different thing because it was musos. It used to be that they wouldn't employ you unless you could play an instrument.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, they did that. I think if you ask Richard, I think he'll say that was still the case when he joined. And, it was musicians' union. It was fighting the musos' corner. NME wasn't. It was a bit more publishers, actually. A bit more Tim Panelli than that. And then you got this. Andy Gray is editing at this point. And then Alan Smith takes over. I don't know exactly when. And Alan is when it kind of opens it up a bit more to the kind of underground press.
Yeah.
And that's when you get Charlie Murray and Nick Kent and these people. And then Nick Logan takes over. And the enemy that people have the fond memory of, I think, is the Nick Logan 74 to 77 enemy, you know, as punk came along and so forth, with Mick Farren and Julie Burchill and Tony Parsons and all those kind of people. And of course, it taking the piss out of everybody, which is great. You know, there's very little of that in this.
Yeah. I mean, for me, Smash Hits was presumably the same as these magazines were for you. But the highlight of my... one of the highlights of my childhood, I actually appeared in Smash Hits.
Oh, wow. In what form? Go on.
It was around September 1984. It's the one with Adam Ant on the front cover. I've still got it. But I don't know why I did it, but I think it's because the magazine, there was no one else you could tell. It was like a threat, you know, like the internet, like you say. Smash Hits was very much like that for me. And none of my friends much cared about Frankie Goes Hollywood. I loved them. And I bought bootleg at Wembley Market, purporting to be their third single, which hadn't been released yet, The Power of Love. And I think, in retrospect, it was a John Peel session or something. But anyway, I bought it. And I played it. This is really good. So I thought, I know, I'll phone Smash Hits.
Tell
which
them.
I did. I'm hoping I spoke to Neil Tennant, but it probably wasn't, but he was still there. In my mind, I'm believing I did speak to Neil Tennant.
And did it get written up?
Yeah. The next week, I was like, ha-ha! And it was the top story on one of the tips or whatever.
It was on Bits. It was on Bits. Yeah, it will have been Neil. That will have been Neil. Because I don't know if he joined at that point. Yeah, probably had. And they used to put him in charge of Bits. And because when I first started Smash Hits, I was in charge of Bits. It was always the bit, you know, you got to do. It was kind of new stuff. And the seven people are good at it. And Neil's really good at it. To the extent Neil did it so much, we used to call him Dr. Bits. Right, still do. It's Dr. Bits calling, you know.
Super.
Dr. Bits and his faithful assistant, Mongo, who's Dave Rimmer. And, so he will have been. Listen, Neil is exactly the kind of person who will have put that in. I'll ask him if he did, if he remembers. He probably does. Of course, the other thing, interesting thing about Smash Hits, it's funny you talk about ringing up, is people just rang up. And they never expressed any surprise that you were there. And so I would, you know, frequently, when I was editor, I used to go in a work weekend. There's stuff to do, you know. And just before kids were born, so I'd be in the office on Sunday, and the phone would just ring and ring. You think, oh, God, I'm not going to answer. Because nobody's got mobile. It might be my wife. I don't know. So I pick up the phone. Smash Hits. And you get some tiny voice on the other end going, oh, yeah, hi, listen. And then they'd launch into some conversation. They would never say, oh, you're there on Sunday, or who am I speaking to, or anything. They would just start. I've heard a story that Annie Lennox is ill, or whatever.
Oh,
you
know? No.
Yeah, it's very sweet, really.
Wonderful Eggpod Express.
So, David Hepworth, I have to come clean. I've actually revised the wrong issue, which is during this issue.
Don't worry.
I interviewed the month after. But yeah, so it's the week ending June the 17th, 1967, of New Musical Express. And I think, yeah, looking back, it's such a joy to go through these because you are experiencing the minutiae of day-to-day, week-to-week life. And it's a pure time capsule. No context. I love doing this, and I'd love speaking to you because I want to know what it's like. I want to know everything. And it seems to be much of what you read was happening, but also there was the mundanity of day-to-day life.
Oh, absolutely. This was a relief from the mundaneness of everyday life. This was just this joy, you know, because you didn't go to school with your headphones in listening to, you know, permanent soundtrack. You didn't do that. Your hunger to hear stuff and see stuff was massive. It was because it wasn't sated at all, you know. Whereas it can't be like that anymore because we've got on tap, you know. It didn't used to be on tap. This is when it wasn't on tap. It's fascinating to see.
So this is the end of the first series of Eggpod Express, but don't worry, it'll be back soon and there'll be all sorts of stuff appearing on Patreon. So thanks to Susie Humphrey for the jingles, and to read this issue of New Musical Express, the magazine's online at iamtheeggpod.com. To support this podcast and to access bonus content, please subscribe to patreon.com/eggpod. We are also finding an exclusive playlist of this week's top 30 singles. But for now, we'll see you soon, but thank you so much, David Hepworth. It's been a joy.
Pleasure. I better do some work now.
Strength.
You've got it. In Louville's Underwater Army.
Each green, speckly spoonful holds an underwater army of enzymes, nature's own stain destroyers. Blueville's enzymes conquer even deep, dried-in stains, egg stains, cocoa, sweat marks, blood spots. Lift them right off the cloth. Then Blueville's own cleansers and brighteners start whiteness where the stain was.
Oh, yes, it's spotless.
Win your war against stains with Blueville's underwater army.
Andy and Anna here from your new favourite podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
Yes, we are two of the four hosts of the podcast that stuffs fascinating, amazing, weird, mad facts into your ears on a weekly basis. You got any good facts, Andy?
Yes, how about this one? Anteaters have evolved on 12 separate occasions.
Wow.
Mysterious. Wonderful.
The world really wants them to exist. What about this one? When Ronald Reagan left office, he left a note on the White House lawn for the squirrels, warning them to beware of George Bush's dogs.
So there you go. If you like fascinating facts and much more besides, we are No Such Thing as a Fish.